Hello and a warm welcome to the very first Physics World Books podcast. I'm James Dacey, a reporter for the magazine, and I'm joined in the studio today by the magazine's editor, Mateen Durrani.
Hello, James.
And the magazine's book aficionado, reviews editor, Margaret Harris.
Hello.
These programmes will bring you the stories behind the stories by discussing some of the latest reviews from the magazine and also hearing from some of the authors themselves. In this debut podcast, the books all share a common theme in that to a greater or lesser extent, they all touch upon the issue of women in science.
A little later, I'll be talking about Caroline and William Herschel, a brother-sister partnership that revolutionized astronomy, as described in Michael Hoskins' new book, Discoverers of the Universe.
Then shush, don't tell anyone, but we'll also be talking about a book called Science Secrets. The historian of science, Alberto Martinez, readdresses some of the established myths of science. This includes the suggestion that Einstein was receiving secret help from his wife in developing his theories.
And finally, I'm going to be looking at a new book called Soft Matter, which really got my goat. It's about things like chocolate mousse, soap bubbles and cement, which doesn't seem to have a link with women in physics, but there is one.
But our first book today is The Madame Curie Complex. The book offers some fascinating ideas about the kind of challenges that women face if they consider a career in science, as Margaret Lee recently found out when she caught up with the book's author, Julie Desjardins, in this interview.
Do you mind just explaining for us what the Madame Curie complex is?
Sure. The name's a little bit borrowed, I have to confess. There was a historian by the name of Margaret Rositer who wrote about Madame Curie coming to the United States in the 1920s. And American women had hoped that this was going to be this great watershed moment for women in science. They thought, you know, wonderful, there would be these male employers in labs who would see this very competent woman as a scientist and think, great, maybe we can start hiring women. And in fact, almost the opposite happened. What happened was Curie came to the United States, and in some ways, the way that the publicity surrounding her tour was handled, it turned out that she created, unwittingly, a sort of inferiority complex among American women who felt that they could never measure up to the perfection of Madame Curie. And unfortunately, this complex has been perpetuated over the decades in various ways. And in the book, as I go up through the 20th century, you can see this way that women feel like they can't compete with men, either in terms of being as scientific-minded as men, but also as perfectly feminine as Curie looked to be in the American press, you know, this perfect mother and wife. And most women feel like they can't measure up to that perfection.
Now, in the introduction to your book, you talk about how you were initially, as a young child, interested in science and mathematics. Mm. And then you either sort of were persuaded or maybe persuaded yourself that that actually wasn't a career for you, because you're a historian, we should make clear.
I am not a scientist, for sure.
Do you think you fell victim to the Marie Curie complex a bit?
Well, you know, obviously it wasn't as if I had that conversation going on in my head at the time, but there's no doubt that I was math-oriented when I was a young girl, and there's no doubt that right about the time where people tell you girls start to get math anxiety, I got math anxiety. I mean, in looking back at it, it's almost embarrassing being a feminist historian and seeing that this was very much what happened to me. And of course, there's all sorts of subtle ways in which this happens, whether it's teachers treating girls differently in the classroom than boys, or girls not wanting to look overly intellectual, you know, once they get into the middle school years, you know, when they become 12, 13, 14. And of course, there's this science pipeline that just keeps dripping girls as you go down. I mean, as girls get into high school and college, and then even if they make it through college and get into careers in science, it seems that, you know, it's very, very difficult for women to make it all the way up to the highest echelons of science. And I was one of those girls. I definitely had convinced myself that I didn't have the math chops to be able to compete in science.
Yeah, you mentioned some other women who've had this, have either been married to scientists or recruited by male mentors or bosses. In particular, a whole group of astronomers at Harvard Observatory who were recruited by a chap called Edward Pickering into the profession. profession. Was this pattern of recruitment, partnership, and mentoring, was it helpful, harmful, or was it, as you say, kind of a bit of a mixed bag in this case, too?
I think you're absolutely right that it was a little bit of both. It's a little complicated because in some ways, again, these men, who I think are very well-intentioned for the most part, they find a way of getting women access to science that, goodness knows, earlier in the 20th century, they would have not had access to. And people like Edward Pickering at the Harvard Observatory, it was his, you know, brilliant idea to bring all of these women with science degrees into the observatory. And that was great because they wouldn't have gotten science jobs otherwise, other than teaching, and usually teaching girls. But the problem is once they got into these jobs, like at the Harvard Observatory, or in Maria Geppert Mayer's case, once her husband got her jobs where he was working at Columbia, University of Chicago, etc., they often were sort of ghettoized, underpaid, and there was no real promise of promotion for these women. I mean, they were treated very much as grunts in these lab settings, to be totally frank. And in the case of the women at the Harvard Observatory, they were in fact real innovators. But of course, they weren't talked about that way. They were talked about as really almost as sort of manual laborers. They were called computers, and they were supposed to sit there and work out computations about where stars were in the sky and read the plates that they got. But the problem is they actually did a lot more work than that, interpretive work, that did not get seen as interpretive work and that men got the credit for. So it was sort of a mixed blessing for these women to be hired by Pickering. It was definitely an in into science, but then they had nowhere to go once they got there. And in the case of Maria Geppert Mayer, interestingly with her, this was a woman who followed her husband to all of these very prestigious universities. And he put her in the proximity to the right people at the right time. And so they got to see her science. And ultimately, she wins a Nobel Prize. But quite literally, the woman was unpaid at any university for about 30 years.
Julie Desjardins, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
So that was Margaret in discussion there with Julie Desjardins in her home in New York. So lots of issues there, weren't there? What do you think, Mateen?
Well, one thing I was going to ask you, Margaret, was obviously the success of Maria Geppert Mayer. To me, that kind of demolished the whole argument that there is this complex. She obviously succeeded and did really well. So why does this complex exist?
Well, I think when you think about the Marie Curie complex, you've got to realize that we're not just talking about the impact that has on, you know, really eminent scientists like Maria Geppert Mayer. You've got to think about how it's going to affect the ordinary postgraduate. And if I think one thing that's important to point out is that if you ask anybody to name a woman in science, they're probably still going to say Marie Curie. And she's been dead for over 70 years. I mean, what's that say about the role models we've got? So if you're an ordinary postgraduate looking at, sort of seeing only one role model there, you probably could get a complex if you're trying to base your efforts on the woman who won two Nobel Prizes.
So did you enjoy the book?
Yeah, I think it was really, really worthwhile because it does give a wider perspective on more women than just Curie and brings it together into a single book. I mean, there have been biographies written about each individual person in this, and I should also say it's not just physics. There's also some discussion of biology as well. But yeah, I thought that it was definitely worth reading.
The Madame Curie Complex is published by the Feminist Press, and it's available now in paperback. Desjardins' book focused on women in 20th century America, but there are earlier examples of the male leader, female assistant pattern that was historically one of the few ways that women could participate in science. One of these is the brother-sister pairing of William and Caroline Herschel. Margaret, can you tell us more?
So William and Caroline Herschel were astronomers working in England in the late 18th century, early 19th century. They're originally from Germany. William came over in 1755, and then he brought his sister along with him later to act as his housekeeper and general dog's body. And when he became interested in astronomy, she joined him in that too. She became his assistant. And so the book really discusses their lives, their relationship together, their discoveries, and also the sort of the time that they were living in.
So taking you up on that theme, Margaret, I mean, what sort of relationship did they have? Was he the dominant partner in the two of them, or was she, as you say, more of a dog's body?
Well, she certainly was his assistant, and I think there's an interesting dynamic here because the educational opportunities that she had in Hanover in, said, the late 1800s were very, very different from those that the women of the Harvard Observatory we mentioned earlier. I mean, they were really highly trained. They had degrees in science. Carolyn, just because of the limited educational opportunity she had, she never learned some of the skills that would have been taken for her to be a scientist really independently. She never learned how to multiply, for example. She had to look that up in tables until she was, in her 80s. But I think to just call her an assistant is maybe just to denigrate her a little bit, because the word assistant, it does imply an inferior role, but it's really important because, William was obviously a great astronomer in his own right, and if she hadn't existed, if she'd stayed in Drudge and back in Hanover, he would have still been a very good astronomer. But her presence really made him from a good astronomer into a great one, and that's not a small contribution.
Did you enjoy reading the book?
Yeah, I did. I mean, Michael Hoskin, the author, is a noted authority on the Herschels, and I thought he really did a good job of bringing out their relationship and the warmth in relationship, and he clearly has a bit of a soft spot for Carolyn, so yes, very good book.
Discoverers of the Universe is published by Princeton University Press, and it's available now in hardback. The sexist norms of the late 18th and early 19th century kept Carolyn Herschel in her brother's shadow for much of her life. But can a similar case be made for the early 20th century physicist, Mileva Maric, better known as Albert Einstein's first wife? Alberto Martinez, in his book Science Secrets, argues that with some regret, the answer is likely to be no. Margaret, can you tell us how this debate came about in the first place?
So Mileva Maric and Albert Einstein were undergraduates together, and she was a physicist as well, and they did discuss physics when they were undergraduates. But the issue is, so that's part of the origin of the myth. And the issue is that by the time Einstein had his miracle year in 1905, Mileva and Albert Einstein had a child 2 years earlier, outside of wedlock, before they were married. And she kind of disappears, and Mileva Maric really stopped doing physics that time. There's really no indication that she actually contributed to relativity. It was really just very early in their career. But I think there's been a certain amount of wishful thinking, Einstein didn't have a really great relationship with women. Mileva Maric was certainly felt she was very badly treated. And so I think there's been some, sets of myth-making surrounding it.
So, I mean, this story of Mileva Maric, that's only one chapter within quite a large book. I mean, what other myths does Martinez debunk?
Well, one of the ones I found most interesting was the myth concerning Galileo supposedly proving Aristotle wrong by dropping lead balls off the Tower of Pisa. So Aristotle said that heavy balls should fall faster than lightweight ones, and Galileo said they should fall at the same time. And Galileo was right, but there's really no indication at the time that he actually performed the experiment. He doesn't claim he performed the experiment. The first record of him having done it doesn't appear until decades after his death. And interestingly, some of his contemporaries who did perform the experiment, they got the wrong answer. So it's not necessarily as clear-cut as the sort of canonical story of Galileo and the Tower of Pisa suggests.
Yeah, but what I found interesting about this book, Margaret, was actually the myths themselves. I mean, you could argue that the myths are actually important because they serve a purpose, they illustrate nice incidents in history that people might have ignored otherwise. And although he's published this book, I doubt any of these myths are going to be really debunked. These myths will endure because people like stories, people like myths.
I think that's probably certainly true. I think Martinez acknowledges that myths do serve an educational purpose. It's a lot more dramatic to envisage Galileo dropping something off the Tower of Pisa. But I think another point he makes is that, the reality is interesting too. And the reality particularly of how these myths are created, how we came to somebody came to think that Mileva Maric contributed to Einstein's papers. And that's interesting as well. And I think that's a real strong point of the book. And I really enjoyed it. I found out interesting things that I hadn't known before about various bits of science.
Science Secrets is published by University of Pittsburgh Press and is out now in paperback. And so we come to our final book, Soft Matter by Roberto Piazza. The connection to our Women in Physics theme is perhaps less obvious here. And for some reason, the book has really annoyed Mateen. Can you tell us why?
Right, this is a book about soft matter. So we're talking polymers, colloids, gels, the kind of things you get in everyday life, like toothpaste and milk and mayonnaise and paint. And what the author's tried to do is write a popular science book aimed at general readers about the science behind these everyday materials, which is all well and good, but he really blotted his copybook with the introduction, where he imagines a day in the life of a dear lady and talks in a really patronising tone about this woman going about her everyday business and encountering these materials that I just mentioned. And it was just horrible, the introduction. I think it's going to put a lot of people off.
Is it really that horrible? Because it's translated from the Italian, and it's possible it's not quite as offensive in the original language. I'm sure that Roberto Piazza would be really mortified if he heard we were talking about his book in this context.
Well, I think his heart was really in the right place, and he tried really hard. I have to say the rest of the book is not bad. It's kind of really good for a graduate student who's starting off and wants to understand the different aspects of this field. But I know I don't agree with you that it was the translation. I think probably it was just as bad in Italian. And I don't know whether an editor or publisher should have warned him off. And he kind of, at the very end of the introduction, makes it even worse by kind of apologising for the introduction, which just really made me cringe.
So, I mean, do you think, is that his audience then, grad students?
Well, ultimately, I think this book would actually be really good. I mean, I did a PhD myself in soft matter, and if I'd read this when I started my degree, I would have found it very useful. The problem is it's not really good for a popular audience because there's no narrative. It's a series of little mini introductions to the different types of material, which is fine, but I'd really doubt that a general reader would want to plough through this.
Soft Matter is available now in paperback, published by Springer. When you join us for our next podcast in December, we'll be announcing our top 10 books reviewed in 2011. Do you think any of today's books will make it onto that list, Margaret?
Well, it's hard to say because, I mean, there's some really good books for you to discuss today, but a lot of them have more historical focus, and I am aware I'm trying to pick the top 10 physics books, not the 10 sort of top 10 history of physics books. So you'll just have to wait and see.
And finally, don't forget, you can read book reviews every month in Physics World and also on our website, physicsworld.com. Thanks for listening. Join us again in December.